Good morning. Yesterday we got more dates and details on the easing of restrictions for the summer. To quote Taoiseach the Leo Varadkar, it will be an outdoor summer, but not outdoors only. And the tantalising possibility of international travel in July, although perhaps not with our nearest neighbours in the UK. More anon. As some cabinet details leaked out on Thursday night, on Late Debate, Katie took the temperature with John Downing of the Irish Independent.
There's a lot ahead of us. It's going to be a big summer.
There is. There's great optimism to come from all of these things between now and we won't know ourselves. I'm personally very much looking forward to a pint with my elbows on the counter, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime terribly soon. It's a curious mix of caution and optimism. The shadow of potentially a stumble in the vaccine distribution, and always fears of new variants and the figures going wrong on us again. Before Christmas, we were all going for a quote-unquote meaningful Christmas. Are we now going for a big summer because we missed last one? I want all these things to happen. I fervently want them all to happen, but I don't want to wind up where we were last January, where very soon the hospital services and the ICUs particularly and all that were on the verge of breaking point. So cautious optimism, you know.
Ooh, did he just say meaningful Christmas? Don't curse us with that one. But as with everything, the devil is in the detail, and not everyone was happy. On Wednesday, Fáilte Ireland released safety guidelines for the hospitality sector. 6 people aged 13 years and over for a table for an hour and 5 minutes if they're 1 metre apart, but if you've got younger children, that changes. No parties inside, no live or loud music, and beddy byes by 11:30. But if you're the seventh son of a seventh son and a Sagittarius who does a mean Macarena with a bronze medal in the Mayo Community Games handball in 2003, well, all bets are off. Joshing, clearly. But when Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin North West Paul McAuliffe joined Cormac on Wednesday's drive time, he took issue with the regulations.
You would almost need a PhD to plan a lunch for you and your family.
You're saying it's too complicated.
It's too complicated, and I also believe that it will make it impractical, and therefore we'll have large-scale non-adherence to the guidelines, and I believe that's far worse. NPHET has a really important role.
If it's too complicated, you're complaining about your own government. Because it's NPHET's advice to give it a job to give advice to the government. It is government's job then to communicate that complicated advice in an effective, simple manner to the public. So you're complaining about your own government.
I am, absolutely. But the reason I'm doing that is that when you look at the guidelines, Cormac, you can have 6 adults and up to 9 children under 13. You can have a table of 15, but you can't equally have a table of 7 adults. What if one of those children is 14? The person who greets you at the door of the restaurant is going to essentially have have a stopwatch and a ruler to try and measure the distance. So we're regulating the amount of time that you'll be at a table if it's less than 2 metres. But if it's more than 2 metres, you can have an unlimited period of time. I just think we need to be moving to broad principles here.
Fianna Fáil's Paul McAuliffe. However, no such measuring tapes needed for Fine Gael Senator and leader of the Shannon, Regina Doherty, who joined Katie on Late Debate. Oh, and by the way, Katie brought us this nugget from former Justice Minister Charlie Flanagan.
Quoted as declaring that a nut roast in a restaurant is probably the same as a nut roast in a hotel.
Well, take it away, Regina.
At the end of the day, I think we need to remind people what caused the third wave, which was the socialising that happened before Christmas. And so we need not lose the run of ourselves and cause a fourth wave. And it has to be steady as she goes and safe. And so everybody wants their liberties back, and anybody who's vaccinated should be demanding them. But it has to be in a safe manner. I know Charlie's point is that it isn't any or more safe to have a nut roast in a hotel than it is in a restaurant. But it's all about the volume of movements. The same way as when we closed things down, it was about the volume of movement. There was no logic in saying that playing tennis was any less safe or more safe than playing football or dancing up the road. It wasn't about that. It was about the volume of movements. And this is the same. So we want to give people back their freedoms, but we want to make sure we try and do it in a manner that's safe so that we can all stay open, stay out, stay socialising, as opposed to having a fourth wave and finding ourselves right back in square one again. So.
But what had the guidelines to say about ventilation? Well, Orla Hegarty is Assistant Professor at the School of Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy at UCD, and she gave her reaction to Claire.
The guideline is quite simple. Either open a window or use a mechanical ventilation system, aircon. Is that the suggestion?
The problem with the guidance, I think, is that it doesn't give any practical advice for people who are running a cafe or a hotel opening next Tuesday. It doesn't address the high-risk areas that we know, particularly staff areas, corridors, lifts, cold rooms, toilets, those back areas where people might be working and staff are at risk. Then it gives very technical advice, I suppose, about engineering equipment, which would apply to some situations. And it doesn't give the sort of practical steps about particular risk of things like those air conditioning units that just chill the air and recirculate it. They have been connected with outbreaks in Asia and people being infected up to 6 metres away from another guest in a restaurant. And more importantly, I think a lot of this 30-page document needs to be rewritten and reframed so that people are not putting a focus on cleaning tip jars and pens. But they're putting absolute core focus on the fact that this virus is inhaled and the only way to protect customers and staff indoors is to have clean air.
And what about the no live or loud music rule? Well, certainly musician and lecturer at Waterford Institute of Technology, Mark Graham, was not a fan.
We did hear in the first hour that Minister Catherine Martin has plans, which she's bringing to Cabinet today, to have these pilot events across lots of different music genres, also comedy and sport and so on. That's going to happen in June and July. Does that give you some hope that there's a willingness now to try and move on?
Not anymore, Claire. The industry is nuanced and it makes no sense at all to stop somebody playing a harp in the foyer of a hotel at a wedding reception, because they're not going to transmit COVID. But yet next week, I can walk down the road here in Tremore and I can get into the swimming pool in Splashworld. And that's great news. But there's an inconsistency here. And I think that, you know, talk of things that might happen down the road, we've been hearing this for a year and a half now. And it's starting to sound a bit like, you know, appeasing an unruly child in the back seat of a car by saying, if you're good, we might get ice cream on the way home. We're adults. We're professionals. Stop the car. Let us out, because your parental methods are lazy and negligent.
Not mincing his words. That was yesterday morning, but by yesterday evening, news that those music guidelines were to be reviewed. But whether and how to open up music venues and so many other aspects of our reopening are dependent on our vaccination rollout. But on Thursday, a problem with, you guessed it, supply. Health Minister Stephen Donnelly warned the Dáil that there may be a shortfall in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Sinead Spain on the News at One brought us this.
For June, we were expecting, contracted to receive about 470,000 doses of Janssen. The best case I have as of this morning is that we would receive about half of that. So that would be about 235,000 doses. And the worst case, which the deputy was looking for as well, believe it or not, deputy, could be as low as around 60,000 in June.
The bombshell news delivered by Health Minister Stephen Donnelly in response to a question from Sinn Féin's David Cullinan. Minister Donnelly had been explaining how half the adult population will have at least one dose of a vaccine by the end of this week, when he was forced to admit that the target of 80% vaccination by the end of June is now looking unlikely. He told Social Democrat co-leader Roisin Shortall the government has no information on how many AstraZeneca doses are on the way.
As we know, unfortunately, the supplies from AstraZeneca have consistently been under. The company has not been able to give detail as to how much it will be under for June, but as soon as I have that, I would make it available.
And then yesterday, more from Minister Donnelly on this.
The Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, was asked whether or not he thought the advice from NPHET on reopening the country had been undermined, given the possible shortfall in vaccines.
The latest information NPHET had was that, yet again, we're seeing very high buy-in to the measures, which gives people a lot of comfort that as we ease the measures, people are still doing the right thing, still sticking with the measures that are that are in place. So, no, NPHET's advice last night to us was certainly on the basis of where we're at with the vaccine programme. And remember, in terms of what may or may not happen with Janssen and AstraZeneca right now, the companies haven't been able to provide certainty. So we still may get large volumes in. Obviously, we have these batches in the US, the Janssen batches. We hope that they're approved by the FDA, approved by the EMA, and that we get them here as soon as possible.
From yesterday's News at One. And all of this against the backdrop of the worrying news of the rise of the B.1.617.2 variant, first identified in India. Here's Sarah on Thursday's Drive Time, just after 5 o'clock.
News just breaking at the moment from the UK. Health Secretary Matt Hancock is saying up to half or as many as three quarters of UK cases are now of the Indian variant, and that COVID cases are rising in the UK.
And we do not want that. Well, on yesterday's Morning Ireland, Áine spoke to Professor James McInerney, Head of School of Life Sciences at the University of Nottingham.
The main question people want to know about the Indian variant, is it more virulent? Is it more contagious?
So, first of all, there's no evidence that it's more virulent, that it on its own, in a like-for-like comparison, causes more hospitalizations or deaths. So there's no evidence for that right now. The feeling is that it is more contagious, that it is outcompeting, if you like, B.1.1.7, which is the Kent variant that was the majority variant here in the UK since the start of the year. But the estimates vary quite a bit as to how much more contagious it is. The estimates vary from between 20% more to 100% more, in other words, twice as contagious. The situation across the country is that hospitalizations are going up. They're still at a low level for COVID, but they are going up. They've gone up about 10% in the week. So that's not good. We're seeing the incidence increase in places where there has been a lot of vaccine hesitancy.
Are the vaccines that we have available less effective against this Indian variant, particularly the AstraZeneca vaccine?
So they're all very effective against this variant, but slightly less so than they would have been against other earlier variants. I think if you were to ask anybody a year ago that if they had a vaccine that was that had an 80% reduction in symptomatic disease, hospitalizations and deaths, you'd have been very, very happy with that. So it's not the 95% that we sort of suddenly got very used to, but the vaccines are still very, very good.
Oh, come on, the rollout. And as we ease our way back into our lives, Brian O'Connell took to the streets to see how people were feeling.
I think it's probably too hard to tell, really. Are we opening up things too soon? We're phasing it well. I wished it was a bit sooner, hopefully. But look, at least, you know, they hopefully will be opening up and that we can maintain it. I think that's the biggest concern that everyone really does have is, will this be it? And will we be able to stay opened?
To be honest, I had a lot more negative thoughts about it a good few months ago than I do now.
Would you be happy to book a slot indoors?
Oh, 100%. I don't really feel that much fear now. My father's vaccinated, my mum is... My sister, she has asthma. The ones I'd be worried about affecting are safe. I have a table booked already outdoors 11th of June with five of my friends, and I can't wait.
Oh, he's not alone there. Back in a bit. Welcome back. So, did you wake up this morning, look in the mirror, twinkle a smile at yourself and go, I am a special, unique and rather valued human being? If so, fair play to you. If not, join the rest of us. But confidence is vital if any of us are to be vaguely happy and fulfilled. Luckily, clinical psychologist and neuroscientist Ian Robertson joined Ryan to talk about his new book, How Confidence Works, and maybe how we can get some.
The great thing about confidence is it's like a fuel additive, that it accelerates its effects, because a little bit of extra confidence makes you do a little bit more. That expands your experiences and your successes, and that multiplies over time, and that happens over a lifetime with people.
Yes.
That's why two kids with exactly the same abilities, one with a tiny bit more confidence at the beginning, that tiny difference exponentially grows and creates a much more yawning gap with time, because confidence creates new opportunities, new experiences, new skills, etc. Whereas if you hold back, you don't get that opportunity.
Okay, so the confident become even more confident. But might there be such a thing as overconfidence?
There is a difference, though, isn't there, between the person who's confident and can back it up with a certain emotional, intellectual ability versus, excuse the language, but a bullshit artist.
Like
Ally McLeod.
Right.
So describe, compare and contrast those two schools of confidence.
Yeah, Ally McLeod, of course, was he was the Scotland team manager who...
He's planning a column B in this example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he... So Scotland had unusually qualified for the World Cup in Argentina. And he created a kind of national delusion because everyone seemed to buy into it. He created this fantasy bubble, and he was asked, for instance, you know, what are you going to do when Scotland wins the World Cup? As he had said, he says, win it again.
A spoof.
It was the most, and so that kind of bubble, that was a kind of farcical bubble of overconfidence, but it shows you that confidence is enormously contagious. It is contagious because it buys you status, because it lifts people's mood, and that's the source of.
But it's a debased currency, is it not? If it's not delivered upon.
Well, yes, it is.
But like it's finite then.
But the problem is, it buys you so much in the short and medium term.
Is that enough?
That it can be self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
So Adam Newman, who created the WeWork, for instance, I mean, so based on the most inflated overconfidence, he was going to cure, you know, stop world wars and stop orphans existing in the world. But he ended up with a multi-billion company valuation. Yeah. And when it finally, the valuation failed, he went out with a huge packet. And so, I mean, with billions of payoff. And so that's the trouble with overconfidence.
Yeah.
And certain nationalities are more prone to this approach than others.
There actually is an objective measure of bullshitting, which is the PISA study of ability across OECD countries.
Mm.
They say, how familiar are you with these mathematical terms from zero, never heard of them, to 10, understand it completely and know it? And they insert five fictitious terms that don't exist in it. And so you get the actual measure of how bullshitty a culture is. And sure enough, which are the most bullshitty countries?
Yeah.
America and Canada. Which are the least bullshitty countries? Well, Scotland's at the very lowest. Ireland's pretty low as well. But you're right. We have this tendency to self-deprecate, to apologise in advance, and seek reassurance. Oh, am I talking rubbish? The trouble with that kind of reassurance seeking and constant self-deprecation, it does actually... the words you say to yourself are important, and it does eat into your confidence.
Yes.
And what's more, it communicates that to the other person. So if you don't appear confident in yourself, why should the other person be confident in you? So we have to be careful we don't fall into the habit of constantly undercutting ourselves, constantly seeking reassurance. This is probably rubbish. Oh, I look terrible today. I'm sorry, it's such a mess.
Could do with brushing the hair, in fairness. But fair point. Ian Robertson with Ryan. Meanwhile, on Drive Time, Friends reunited. I'll be there for you. Maybe.
Cormac, which friends are you?
I'd say I'm Rachel.
Rachel.
Kind
on
of
basis.
Good looking and kind of not taken for granted a little bit, but bringing real value to the show.
Wow.
Which one are you, Sarah?
I'm Monica. Because apparently I give the best to worst massages.
By God, you are. God, we better end this conversation before.
I think we better.
Huh? Oh, not awkward at all. Moving on. On the very last book show of the season, Rick and Afric O'Connell went out on a high. Copyright law.
Slightly different rules for the EU and the US as well. Stick with us on this.
Yes. So generally in the EU, and generally is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence, but it's life plus 70 years for copyright. The US is slightly different, slightly more complicated. The same is true, life plus 70 years, except for works published before 1978, which were given extra time. So it's 95 years. That change is referred to by skeptics as the Mickey Mouse Protection Act because it kept Steamboat Willie which was the first iteration of Mickey Mouse under copyright until 2024. So we can all use Mickey Mouse in 2 years' time for whatever purposes we see fit.
And create our own theme parks.
Fair enough, and always good to learn. But as they pointed out, if your favourite book is out of copyright, this can lead to a lot of scope for creativity and fun. Yes, copyright fun, such a thing may just exist.
This is the big year for The Great Gatsby. There's a lot going on, isn't there?
Yes, there is. There's a lot happening with The Great Gatsby this year. People are very excited about it because it is one of the most iconic American novels of all time. It is now in the public domain, which means we're going to have things like Muppets adaptations. We're going to have zombie adaptations. There is something on the way called The Gay Gatsby by B.A. Baker. And in the tradition of Pride and Prejudice and zombies, The Great Gatsby Undead by Kristen Bray.
You see, that discussion on copyright was far more entertaining than you thought it was going to be.
It actually was. Now, there's been a lot of talk recently about the dark net, that nasty corner of the internet. But what exactly goes on there? Paul C. Dwyer, CEO of Cyber Risk International, took Claire on a guided tour of the darkness. And it's surprisingly easy to access.
There's a website basically that people would visit to download a piece of software that takes literally minutes to install. And when that software is installed, you simply load that software up and you're able to access the dark web.
Is it a dangerous thing to do, to access it?
Well, yes, because it's essentially the dangerous part of town. If you think about it in relation to the physical world, you're going to a really bad part of town where there's lots of criminals, there's lots of bad things happening. And a lot of people who visit it essentially become victims themselves.
Dwyer told us that the dark net had been invented by the US Navy to protect the anonymity of its own analysts. And this in turn has led to legitimate organisations, the BBC for example, using the dark net as a safe space for whistleblowers. But really, it's a mucky marketplace where you can get just about anything if you can pay.
First thing is that people, if they visited the dark web, is they would be shocked at the indecent imagery of children and child abuse imagery that's for sale. And about 80% of the traffic is of that nature. The marketplaces themselves operate, essentially, they look very like an eBay. And they have customer ratings, they have different price points, and the different traders on selling their wares through those marketplace websites. And that's anything from drugs, guns, fake IDs, crimeware. So crimeware is software used to carry out cybercrime. You can hire specialists, crime as a service, to carry out different parts of crime. So if you weren't able to hack into someone's mobile phone, you can hire someone to do that for you. And it's pretty much a marketplace of everything that's unlawful in the world.
You sent us some examples of this, and what I'm looking at here now is a screen sample that explains to me how much I would need to pay if I wanted to murder somebody, have somebody murdered. And it goes through, is the person a regular person and gives a price for that? Someone who you'd like to have declared missing in action? Someone you'd like to have declared dead in an accident, and the prices go on in that way? Can you just describe that for people?
Sure. I mean, essentially, there's a lot of fake murder for hire sites out there, but there's also essentially real ones. And there's lots of real life cases of people being caught hiring people to murder people through these sites as well. And a lot of these sites, the success of them there is based on the fact that they're community driven. So by that, I mean, is that if someone's going to trust that website, they're looking at previous customers' testimonials or proof of evidence that something has actually happened, whether it's a beating. And on that particular price list, you can see there's even prices to rape or beat people up and so on as well. Mm-hmm. And this is basically violence for hire. One of the most famous stories on the dark web is the Silk Road Marketplace, which turned over $1 billion in its first year selling drugs. But the founder of that website himself was arrested by the FBI for trying to hire someone to kill one of his business partners.
Lovely. And if maybe the Silk Road founder isn't so savoury, the site itself is very user-friendly. And if you're so inclined, you can buy cocaine and ease your middle-class conscience by making sure it's fair trade. I kid you not.
Silk Road turned, as I say, over $1 billion in its first year of trading. And that was mainly drugs. What they were touting was that it was safer to buy high-quality drugs on a site like Silk Road as it was to maybe go to a nasty part of town, maybe get poison drugs, something to cut up with something else, maybe get beaten up, your money stolen. And this was a way to introduce people into experimenting with drugs, getting high-quality stuff, all of that. And that was their premise, and that was why they were so successful. So there's a challenge for society on how, you know, different generations are going to operate if they have the availability and the use to be able to use this kind of technology mm-hmm. and get it delivered in the post safely. If you ethically want to buy your cocaine from a fair trade farmer, that was available too. And I mean, these guys are business people. They're entrepreneurs. They embrace innovation and technology. And they're brilliant at it. I mean, most ratings up there are a 4.5-star to 5-star rating because their customer service is absolutely fantastic.
And the possibility of shutting it down?
It's a bit like a whack-a-mole game. There is more that can be done by technology companies. So it's not a helpless thing. You know, it's something that we need more resources and more effort into doing it, and more pressure on the software companies.
Paul C. Dwyer of Cyber Risk International with Claire. Pigeons. Love them, hate them, or if you run a Tesco in Wexford, put up a net to catch them lest they foul the car park. On Thursday, Liveline callers were all over this one, and it turned quite existential in parts.
But you keep pigeons?
I do, yeah.
But do you shoot pigeons?
I do, yeah. Different times of the year, farmers will ring me up and ask me to go and do crop protection for them, shoot wood pigeons or shoot feral pigeons for them.
But all Shane, crows. How are you a pigeon keeper and a pigeon killer at the same time?
Well, do you eat meat, Joe?
Yeah, of course I do, yeah. Well, not of course, okay. I do.
No, of course,
very,
but you do,
very,
yeah.
Very little, yeah.
You know, like, you're eating...
I love
it. You eat beef or you eat chicken or you eat duck, but then you can still appreciate looking at cows in the field or sheep or lambs bouncing about, you know?
So why, are the nets to catch and kill the pigeons in Tesco, or the nets are there to deter... would the pigeon see the net and then turn back and tell his mates...
No, well, you see, it all depends. If that's an indoor car park and they put up nets and they catch the pigeons in it, there has to be somebody there to go and dispatch the pigeons if they're caught in it or release them, let them out.
Say there isn't a facility. What does a pigeon die of if he's caught in the net?
He'll die of starvation or dehydration.
Ah, that's cruel.
Yeah.
Yep. Comes to us all, Joe. And then Aisling, who's quite partial to a bit of pigeon, if they're good looking, maybe with a little bit of Coleman's on the side.
You hate pigeons as well?
Oh, no, Joe. A wood pigeon, like the first man was talking about, that he shoots and eats. Lovely, lovely to listen to in the early morning and the evening time. But the feral pigeons you get around town, they're an absolute nuisance.
Yeah.
No, you don't need that kind of thing. And as they put up the net around the car park...
But is it not, Aisling, is it not the circle of life?
Oh, of course it is. We have to live with these things.
Do you not love to hear the cooing of a pigeon?
Oh, I do, a lovely wood pigeon, absolutely, Joe. It's lovely to listen to. But them old pigeons that you see around town going around with the limps and the wonky eyes and everything, they're full of disease. You see them in Houston Station. But sure, what their problem was in Wexford was is that the people were going in through the car park and mm-hmm. what the pigeons were fouling on the ground were being brought into the supermarket. You can't have that. That problem has to be sorted.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
You can't. We've all have to wear masks going in. Pigeons, you know, poo, as you were calling it, on our feet. No, we can't have that. You know, it's not health and safety. You know, but I do like pigeons, Joe. I love to hear them. Wood pigeons now. And you can eat them. They're nice. I wouldn't eat an old city pigeon.
Only the lookers for Aisling. Liveline on Thursday. On Monday, Christy Moore came into studio to Ray to wish Bob a happy birthday. But then the chat went off on its own merry way and it was a really relaxed and enjoyable listen.
Oh, geez, man, it's great to be doing something. It's great. I mean, I'm really enjoying this, just getting out and sitting down, having a chat with you, singing a few songs. Because when you sing songs to yourself, it's a very different thing, you know. Yeah. It's
Although you say in that you do sometimes you songs that you don't bring out for the general public, sometimes you sing to yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do have songs that I would never gig.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you sing them out loud or in your head?
No, that's a ridiculous question. I'd be singing them. I sing them quietly.
Right.
Usually at night or just quietly.
Like a whisper.
Yeah. Maybe. Absolutely. Like a whisper. Yeah.
Right.
You seem surprised.
No, I'm just trying to imagine it.
Okay.
I'm just trying to imagine it. What it's like. What is it? A sort of a. Is it? Give us an. Sorry, I'm just curious about it. Give us an example, though. Do you have the guitar with you, or would it be?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Well, if I didn't, that wouldn't stop me.
Yeah.
As I walked out on a May morning, to the verdant braes of Skreen, I spied a land near a barnyard side, and hay all worn and wan to see, and hay all worn to see. That's a song I heard Al O'Donnell singing way, way back in the day, and I just loved the song. And I would sing some of the songs like that.
That's lovely.
To myself.
That's lovely. It's like an adult lullaby.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was wondering why you were falling asleep there.
You're exhilarating company, Christy.
And the chat went all kinds of places, including the deep and meaningful.
What do you know about being human? I know that's a big question, but like you're 76 now, and you've been through an awful lot, and you've met so many people, and you've thought about things deeply over the years. What do you think? What is it to be human? What do you feel it is to be Christy Moore? To be, you know, like the it's I'm suppose it's very, I'm asking the meaning of life, Christy.
No,
that's what I'm asking.
It's very confusing. It's very scary. It's frightening. It's beautiful. It's heartwarming. It's privileged. You know, it's life is wonderful, but it can be cruel.
Right.
And it's a kind of a question that can only be answered with cliches.
Where do you get solace from when you're, you know, I know you have conversations with your parents and maybe you whisper a song or two.
I love being at home.
Do you?
That's the one thing the last year has given me, is I've been at home every night for the last 14 months and I've grown very, very fond of it.
You're right. Yeah. So does that mean we won't get you out gigging again? Or?
Well, you know, definitely if I get the chance, I'll gig again, but I find it hard leaving home now. I'm very happy at home with my wife.
Isn't that lovely?
It is lovely. We met up 50 years ago next year.
In MacDade's and you're
in MacDade's and Harry smitten. Street. Instantly.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really beautiful. And then this came in.
I saw Christy at Fela, Trip to Tip, 1992. There was a vendor selling bags of Christy's sweat.
Fair play. It was Pat Short.
Do you want a voice of Christy Moore sweat? Oh, God, that's great.
Oh, I bet that's for sale on the dark net. Christy and Ray, Kildare's finest. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Monday was Bob Day, because you would need to have been under a rolling stone, yes I did, to not know Dylan was turning 80. Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. Everybody that was hanging out, now you don't talk so loud, now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next. The first of many criminal fades of the music, for which I do apologise, but go and listen, because as every contributor on the wireless all day long agreed, Dylan had changed everything. But which Bob would be blowing out the candles, because there are just so many of them? Sean Latham is the director of the Institute of Bob Dylan Studies in the University of Tulsa, and he spoke to Sean on Arena.
You talk about how almost untouchable, how unfathomable he is, how we can't actually get at who he is. It's very difficult to do that. To what extent is it difficult because Dylan himself loves this process of myth-making?
I think he loves the process of mythmaking because it gives him a chance to go inhabit all of the different selves that sort of constitute, I think, what for him is an American set of identities, that there's no one right way to inhabit what it means to be an American. And Dylan loves to explore all of the traditions that go into that, musically, ideologically, politically, socially. So that's why we can get the sort of happy rocker from the or the happy folk singer, rather, from the early 60s. We can get the politically engaged activist from the mid-60s, the rocker from 1966, the country performer, the crooner. All right, he manages the gospel singer. I mean, he covers nearly every genre of American music. And I don't think there's really a Dylan to get to, because Dylan himself is saying these are all different pieces of me and of what it means to be an American popular music performer.
And as Country Time presenter and longtime Bobcat Brian Lally with Claire put it, yes, Dylan is folk, but he's also everything else.
Critically, Bring It All Back Home, Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 were recorded in the space of about 15 months. Three of the extraordinary albums of all of rock and roll music, and not a folk song on them, which is another side of Bob Dylan, because he keeps getting referred to as a folk singer. He was a folk singer for three albums. And then another side of Bob Dylan came along. And that was when he kicked open the door of songwriting, because he just threw away the rule book.
And joining Brian and Claire was musician Cauch O'Riordan. And it was Dylan's pure contrariness that drew her to him, almost more than the music.
At some point I was working with someone, they started referring to Bob as a member of the Awkward Squad. And I'm like, who's the Awkward Squad? They said, it's Bob Dylan, it's Neil Young, it's Tom Waits, it's Lou Reed. And I just thought, Bob's the only one out of the Awkward Squad that I'm not really into as an artist. I'm more into him as this my weird Uncle Bob who does eccentric things. You know, someone will come in the studio and say, have you heard what Bob's done now? And they're not talking about a record. Yeah. You say, what's he done now? He's joined the Grateful Dead. We all go, classic Bob.
But even as a very early developing artist, he was in the Awkward Squad. I mean, imagine this. At the age of maybe 22, he's invited on to the Ed Sullivan Show, which is the biggest program in American television. Now, he wants to do a thing called Talking John Birch Society Blues, which is a very anti-communist
paranoid
song.
Paranoia blues.
And he wants to do that. The record company and the TV company don't let him do that. And he says, sodgy, all I'm off. Yeah. I'm not going to do the Ed Sullivan Show. And he did that like loads of times.
And Dylan's ability to entirely reinvent popular music was something unique. Just listen to this.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 side forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard rain is gonna fall.
So Brian, that's the start of another song, that line.
Every single line in that song is the start of another song, or could be the start of another song. It's like you do an interview on the radio. You know, you're talking to someone and you say, well, where have you been? What did you see? Who did you meet? What are you going to do now? It's like a well-structured radio or TV interview. And then all the answers come out in this extraordinary torrent of words. And the lines in it are visceral. You know, I saw one man who was wounded in love. I saw another man who was wounded in hatred. I mean, it's just now thinking about it, the hairs are standing up on the back of my neck. Extraordinary. And it shows you how, and he was 22 when he wrote it.
A child.
That's the extraordinary thing. Because before that, it was Moon and June and I Love You and You Love Me and Oh How Happy We Will Be. And this just kicked the door open.
Yeah.
And while there were many imitators, few could really compete. Cauch and Brian told this story, which is both cutting and very entertaining. Poor Donovan.
I think Donovan was the first next Dylan because he was 5 years younger than Dylan. So Donovan's sitting there with a guitar in his hand and God love him. It's awfully twee and flower power. And he's singing this song, you know, if the night makes you feel sad, I'll make you feel not so bad. That's what I'll do. I'll sing a song for you. And Dylan is sitting there, goes, hey, man, that's a good song. And you just, I hear the theme from Jaws at that point. I'm like, there is chum Brilliant. In the water. Here comes the great white shark. And sure enough, apparently Donovan said, OK, Bob, now you play a song.
And he then plays this.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you better grab it fast. He understands you're orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, the saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue.
It's a bit mean, Brian. Come on, but, a bit mean.
The visual as well, I mean, because Bob looks over at Donovan at the line, when the line is, yonder stands your orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. In other words, yeah, it's a Champions League, you know.
Yeah.
The movie says the vagabond who's rapping on your door is standing in the clothes that you once wore.
Oh, mother of God.
Ooh, ouch is right. But if Donovan was, well, not really up there, for Dylan, few would compare with the Clancy brothers, and Liam in particular. Here's critic John Marr with Sean on Arena.
It was both the way, the songs themselves, but particularly the way the Clancy brothers delivered them.
Absolutely. And he said, what I heard in the Clancy brothers were rousing rebel songs that were Napoleonic in scope, and they were just these musketeer-type characters. But then, on the other level, they had the romantic ballads that would just slay you in your tracks, the sweetness of Tommy Makem and Liam. It was like a sword that would take off your head. And that fascination with them, just this sense about what the White Horse Tavern had been to him as a young green character straight from Minnesota in the big city. I think he loved the rousing balladry of the Clancys, but also, I suppose, their ability to tell stories. And Dylan is such a brilliant storyteller, and he can capture those in 4 or 5 minute songs.
And that storytelling ability had its origin in a fierce intellect, as Dylan scholar Sean Latham noted.
Dylan writes and researches and revises and cuts more than he adds and tosses aside thousands of, maybe 1,000 songs for every song he releases. It's an astonishing amount of work that goes into a Dylan song. So there is intellectual credibility there.
Yeah. So what has the access to the archive opened up for you there?
I mean, I think essentially what it allows you to do is go into the workshop of Daedalus. So, you know, as far as we know, when Dylan songs release, we just think of Dylan as a romantic poet. These things sprung Athena-like from his forehead, fully formed, right? And fans, of course, latch onto them or hate them or whatever. But you don't really know much about how the songs get made, their context, what Dylan was reading at the time or listening to at the time. And I can tell you that in the archive, what you find are not just drafts and drafts and drafts of songs, but notebooks that Dylan's keeping where he's writing down songs he wants to listen to or where he's experimenting with different kinds of songs. He's also keeping shopping lists and measurements for new curtains and all that kind of stuff in these notebooks as well. But you see him working and reading and researching and writing down phrases from the Bible and other sources that he finds interesting. So what the archive lets us do is actually go in and see, how did he make these songs? How did they grow, you know, from an idea jotted down on a page one summer's day in 1966 to a masterpiece?
Last word on this to Bobcat Brian Lally.
Salute him when his birthday comes, as he said himself in one of his songs, and it's great to be here on the 80th.
Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.